And now, two pigeons bemoaning the fact you can stream DirecTV satellite-free.
You see this?
A family watching baseball on DirecTV with no satellite dish in sight.
Let's heckle them.
You call that changing the channel?
Choke up on the remote, buddy!
I hope getting all these games on DirecTV makes up for your mother not pre-chewing your sunflower seeds!
DirecTV has the most MLB games. Call 1-800-DIRECTV. Claim based on total games carried on sports networks. Sports availability varies by zip code and requires choice package. Terms and restrictions apply.
The Athletic.
Instead of taking up that gym membership that you wouldn't use even if the gyms were open, how's about subscribing to The Athletic for just £4 a month as a New Year's resolution? You'll get unrivaled football coverage with analysis and in-depth features from the very best writers around, exclusive Q&As with Athletic staff, and ad-free versions of all of The Athletic's podcasts, including this one. Find out more and sign up today at theathletic.com/totally.
Totally Football Show. Today, Chelsea call on Tuchel but barely tickle. Man City are too cool for Baggy's tackles. Or shock at Old Trafford as Sheffield United took all 3 points. We round out the midweek games. Plus, on this day, call your mum, the Ibra v Lukaku battle. And one half of the planet's biggest game of the season. It's all coming up in the Totally Football Show in association with Paddy Power. Hello, listener. It's Thursday, the 28th of January, and I'm delighted to say that here with us on The Totally Show, we have Duncan Alexander.
Hello, James.
Michael Cox.
Hello, James.
And also the returning Natalie Gedra.
Hola, James.
Hola to you too, and indeed to all of you and you, listener. Duncan, exciting to have you on board. What a game your Wickham gave Spurs on Monday night.
Did they? Did they, though? Don't judge a book by its cover. It looks, you know, Wickham took the lead and it was still a draw until the very late stages, but it wasn't really that sort of game. Wickham only had one more shot after scoring in the 25th minute and Tottenham should have been well clear before that, really.
Well, you say that. This was the FA Cup, of course, fourth round, and you were 1-1 with 4 minutes to go. Onye Dinwar had scored the opener, then Bale had got that equaliser, Gareth Bale. And then with 4 minutes to go, you're 1-1. And then what happened?
Then Spurs scored 3 goals. They did manage to bring on Højbjerg, Son, Harry Kane and Ndombele, which is not a bad quartet as it goes, which, you know, guess what, made a massive difference. And yeah, they deserved the win. It wasn't the sort of game where you were like, oh, no, we came so close to going to extra time. The game at Spurs 3 years ago was, or 4 years ago, was much more along those lines, but it was still interesting. I mean, Gareth Bale, it's always interesting when you see a player like Gareth Bale do well in a game like that, because it's high enough for people to sort of legitimately say, oh, maybe he's coming back into form, yet not quite high enough that you could probably, I mean, I doubt he's going to play much of a role against Liverpool tonight.
Thursday evening. Give us a crazy stat about Wickham's last two clashes with Spurs.
Yeah, I mean, Chris Slegg at the BBC worked out that they've only led, Spurs only led for about 8 minutes in the combined 180 of the two games, but they've scored 8 goals and won both games. So, quirky.
Football, eh? Spurs, as their reward, will have a trip to Goodison to take on Everton in the fifth round. In other cup news, Bournemouth on Tuesday beat Crawley, who'd put Leeds out in the previous round, a 2-1. The Cherries' victory there. They'll be away at Burnley in round 5. Excitingly, Jack Wilshere scoring Bournemouth's opener in that game. His first goal since August 2019. Wow. By the way, some quick quiz news. The Athletic, with the help of Prostate Cancer UK, are going to be putting on 31 club football quizzes across February and March to find out who their most knowledgeable subscriber is. If you're not a subscriber yet, by the way, sign up now and find out more about this at theathletic.com/PCUK. There's going to be a quiz for every team The Athletic covers, plus one each for the Bundesliga, Serie A and La Liga. Each will be hosted by the relevant correspondent, and the winners of each quiz go through to a grand final at the end of March, where there's £1,000 up for grabs. Woohoo! All right. Duncan, Michael, Natalie, and you, listener, we're going to be dropping in some quiz questions throughout this podcast just to get you all warmed up. So stay on your toes. Oh, here's one. West Ham play Liverpool this weekend. Steven Gerrard famously scored two of Liverpool's goals in the 2006 FA Cup against the Hammers. Who got the other one?
Cissé.
Oh, for goodness sake.
I don't think I'm even going to try to compete with Michael, honestly.
Well, we'll see, Natalie. Early days. Anyway, the midweek Premier League action. You probably all saw the scores. Massive win for the Baggies. Massive win for Man City against the Baggies. 5-0. That's their 11th straight victory, Man City. West Ham continued their perfect start to the year with a 3-2 win at Palace. Leeds had a nervy 2-1 win at Newcastle, while Arsenal came from behind to take a 3-1 win at Saints. On Wednesday, Thomas Tuchel's debut for Chelsea produced some lovely passing stats, but no goals against Wolves. It was 0-0 for Brighton and Fulham 2. 1-1 between Everton and Leicester. Burnley beat Villa 3-2. That's their third straight win, the Clarets. And in the first v last clash at Old Trafford, Sheffield United, bottom of the table Sheffield United, winless until this January, Sheffield United beat Manchester United 2-1. Crikey. All right then. Duncan, you made this your viewing choice on Wednesday evening.
Well, I also, a couple of weeks ago, said that I thought that Sheffield United could still stay up, and I was roundly mocked. But yep. Who's laughing now? Brackets, no one yet, but there's less laughter than there was.
So they are still 10 points from safety with 18 games to play, which doesn't sound impossible, but I think they still need to make up 26 from the remaining 18 to reach the minimum points total that a team has ever survived with. But you're sticking by this, yes?
It's still a massive long shot, but it is possible, yeah. I mean, they're in no way one of the worst three teams in the Premier League, I would say.
Well, in one way, they definitely are. In quite a crucial way, they are.
Well, no, because you can only judge it at the end of the season. It's a marathon, not a sprint, official.
So they've now picked up 4 wins in 5 in all competitions, but this is only their second victory in the league. It's the first time they've beaten United since the opening day of the first ever Premier League season, way back in 1992. And Iturralde says, where does this rank amongst the all-time upsets in Premier League history? Well, it's actually not that amazing. United lost against the bottom team in the Premier League back in 2018, only a couple of years ago, under Jose Mourinho, when it was West Brom who got a victory.
But they weren't leading the league. And this time it was like a 35-point gap between the two of them. So I think it was different circumstances.
To answer that question as well, there's a forgotten kind of United losing to the bottom team in February 2011. And everyone forgets United was still unbeaten going into that game. They lost to Wolves. And it was the same day that Arsenal threw away a 4-goal lead and drew 4-4 at Newcastle. It's arguably the greatest day in Premier League history, that 5th of February 2011. So there we go.
But Natalie, fair point. This ranks among the biggest upsets then.
Yes, it does, definitely, because the difference between them, it's just on the table, it's outstanding. And before we talk about Man United, regarding still Sheffield United, Phil Gagnelka, what a great story. Like 38-year-old, he was leading the team. He had a very energetic performance in such an important game against Man United. So, yeah, and you could see glimpses of Sheffield United 2019-20 in the way that they were defending and imposing their physicality, which for me was a surprise because we haven't seen much of that during this campaign. I think Sheffield United's position and their points, they make Sheffield United look much worse than they actually do on the pitch, because their performances are not this tragedy that we see on the table. But yesterday, I think we saw more of that Sheffield United from last season, yeah.
So you mentioned physicality there, and certainly that was a complaint from Man United about the opening Blades goal, where on a set piece, and yes, United have conceded a third of all their goals this year from set pieces. But anyway, on the corner coming in, there was a foul on De Gea, Ole Gunnar Solskjaer felt. What do you guys make of it?
I thought that was the one instant where they couldn't really feel aggrieved, because I'm not sure it was a foul on De Gea. I think they can feel slightly unlucky with the disallowed goal at the other end, because I don't think that was a foul on Ramsdale when Martial put the ball in. I think they were unlucky in a couple of ways. I mean, the winning goal, I know, was bad defending, but it was also quite a lucky deflection that hit the bar and went in. I think we tend to kind of read a lot into results, But I don't think Manchester United are anywhere near as good as their recent good run of form would suggest. And I didn't think this was a disastrous performance. I think had this ended in a draw, you would have said fair enough. Had Manchester United kind of pinched the win, it would have been in keeping with their performance from previous games. So it was a funny one. But I'm pleased for Sheffield United because, as Natalie says, when you watch them for 90 minutes, they're nowhere near as bad as, well, they're on 5 points from 19 going into this game, which is just, yeah, it is ridiculous. And Duncan's right, in many ways, they're not one of the worst three teams in the Premier League. So it's good to see them get a moment.
I was trying to think the last time I'd seen a goal at Old Trafford that looked like Sheffield United second. And I thought it was probably in Soccer Aid. It did look like a kind of, you know, towards the end of a game, and everyone's a bit tired and can't really get it out of the box. And then someone sort of lashes it in. But it does make you realise how impressive Derby's 11 points is, because it feels now, whatever happens, Sheffield United are going to surpass that. And to, you know, to get 11 across 38 games is just extraordinary.
Right, OK. So they're on 8, just past the halfway point, but beginning to show signs, as Natalie says, of last season's form. Why is that, do you think? Why are we now beginning to see the blades getting a bit sharper?
They've got the biggest underperformance on XG this season. They're 9 goals. They've scored 9 goals fewer than you'd expect. So, and everyone knows they've struggled to find a consistent goal scorer. And you know, maybe that's easing off a bit now. You know, they're kind of, the luck will change a little bit in the second half of the season. They, as we've said seemingly numerous times already today, that they are not as bad as the league table would have them, and they're not as bad in many metrics as well. So, yeah, there is going to be a struggle, but I can see them at least, you know, overtaking West Brom pretty soon. Anyway,
I think what's notable about them as well is that they really haven't changed their plan at all. You know, I don't think I've ever seen a team suffering so much in the league that hasn't tried to do something completely different. They've stuck to their plan A, maybe in terms of points that hasn't worked particularly well. But I think when you see that second goal yesterday, and obviously the main thing you look at it is terrible defending from Manchester United, but that is really what Sheffield United have attempted to do over the last 2 or 3 years. They work the ball into those corners. They always seem to have a man over. They work a 4-3 or something like that. People talk about the overlapping centre-backs, but it's not like really a counter-attacking tactic. It's because they want to be patient when they get the ball into those situations and work a good cutback situation. I think if you look at the kind of freeze frame for that goal, as the ball goes in, they've got about 7 players within 20 yards of the goal. And that is difficult to defend against, albeit Manchester United made it look even more difficult than it probably was.
Their attempts to reach safety next see them up against Man City. What do you think about that, Duncan? Bold predictions from you on the clash with City?
I feel this might be a tougher assignment, particularly as it stands. I mean, obviously, as we've discussed, they benefited from some slightly lax defending, and that's definitely not anything we've seen from City for what feels like 2 or 3 months now. So,
how will City deal with their physicality? I should mention that Sheffield United haven't actually scored a Premier League goal against Manchester City since Young at Heart by the Bluebells was number one, which of course was April 1993. That's a long time.
Would you know who was in the Sheffield United team the last time they went away at City in a league game? Chris Wilder.
Kamara.
Oh. You got Chris, right? Yeah. No, Chris Wilder himself. So.
Really?
Yeah. Chris Wilder is younger than that Japanese player that's still playing in
the Kazumura.
Yeah. So, I mean, it's Maverick, and I'm not sure it fits in with the Premier League squad rules. But Wilder should maybe give himself a run out against City and rest some players for the next game.
It's an idea. We'll talk about Man City later on. They are, of course, fresh from their 11th straight victory. What about Man United, though? Anything that... is this one of those little blips that can happen to a team who are otherwise riding high in the league? Or was there something else? Was it a case of the fact that they'd played twice against their biggest rivals, probably Liverpool, and they switched off a little here, maybe? I mean, when the first goal went in, they didn't actually seem that bothered. They always go behind anyway.
Yeah, we can discuss VAR and we can disagree with the decisions, especially with Man United's goal and Sheffield United's first goal. But regardless of VAR, United just didn't do enough on first half, especially to lead the match. And I know we have discussed United's mentality so many times, and they have showed that they can fight back. But sometimes things just still get flat. You know, it's becoming more rare. But I think it was the case yesterday, because sometimes you look at the pitch and you don't see the desire that you expect from Man United. Again, I think it is becoming more and more rare. But yesterday, Sheffield United's second goal, as much as it is hard to defend, and I agree with that, the body language didn't go United's way. You look at the goal and it was just poor. Everybody was poor.
Well, will their attitude improve this weekend when they travel to Arsenal, I wonder? Before we move on, should we get your thoughts on that? Arsenal coming off an impressive come-from-behind 3-1 win at St Mary's. What was the difference between this game and the one they had at the weekend in the Cup?
A big difference would be the players that were on show. I mean, I was surprised that Arteta rotated so much for that FA Cup game, considering I think that should have been a competition Arsenal could have prioritised. They've got a great recent record in it. But they're very good, Arsenal. I thought they were excellent. I mean, we talk about Southampton's pressing a lot of the time, but it was Arsenal's pressing really that was the main theme, particularly in the first 20 minutes. I thought they did that really well, particularly when Southampton were dropping a man into the defence to build up play. And then when they lost the ball, they weren't in a good defensive shape to actually defend the attacks. But yeah, Arsenal look better overall. And I think sometimes when it's the fringe players that are looking good, you know you're onto something good and you've got a decent side. I thought Cedric Suarez had a really good game here at left back. The last time Kieran Tierney was out, I think it was that 0-0 against Palace at home, and everyone said Arsenal need a left-footed option from the left, and it certainly helps, especially the way Tierney's been playing. But Suarez, I mean, I don't know whether it was because he was back at his old club or something, but I thought he was absolutely excellent. And Partey's return as well. I mean, I think when Arsenal signed him, they really were making a decision that they were going to almost base the side around him. I think he's good enough to kind of fall into that category, almost the way Bruno Fernandes has done for Manchester United. I know he's a different player, but he's that kind of all-action midfielder who can do a bit of everything. And I think his return has really made Xhaka look better alongside him. Xhaka's a frustrating player, but I think with the right role and with the right partner, he can look good. And obviously Saka, again, we have to mention, he's just... I mean, he can play almost any position. He's so two-footed. He's really good tactically. His decision-making is great. So, yeah, I think the game of the weekend should be really interesting because, I mean, before Sheffield United, the last time that Manchester United lost in the league was that game at home to Arsenal, when I thought that was maybe Arsenal's most impressive tactical performance of the season. So, yeah, I'm really looking forward to that game.
Yeah, that was 1-0 back in November at Old Trafford with Pierre-Emerick Aubameyang scoring the winner. He's been out for the last couple of games and... some doubt about whether he's going to be available for this one. We might see Martin Ødegaard, of course, who just arrived on loan from Real Madrid. The Palace draw 0-0, the only time in the last six games that Arsenal have actually dropped points in the league. Chelsea, Brighton, Baggies, Newcastle are now Saints, the victories in there. What do you think, Duncan and Natalie? Are Arsenal going to continue their recent form?
Yeah, I think... it's becoming very interesting to watch Arsenal because, and then we have to talk about Mikel Arteta. You can see that he's getting his ways in some aspects of the team. After the match, after the Southampton match, Saka gave an interview and said that Arteta makes everything clear for him, so he knows what to do on the pitch. At the same time that Arteta gives him freedom to play his game. So you have the feeling that players are finding themselves more on the pitch. And if you see that brilliant pass from Cedric Suarez to Saka on Lacazette's goal, that's exactly it. I remembered once I was speaking to a Man City player a couple of seasons ago, and they were talking about the importance of finding themselves on the pitch, that they trained with GPSs because, well, most teams do that. But how important is this for players to know the other players' movements and to know what they were about to do and to think? So I think we're starting to see that from Arsenal, and how important was it for Arteta to make these changes? The players that came in and gained more space, like Smith Rowe, Saka, they really seem to embrace the idea. It's a bit like when Mikel arrived. So really starting to shape a squad that looks like him. It's a long process, but I see it happening more now.
What I think is interesting as well is if you go back a couple of months, there was a lot of criticism of Guardiola and also Arteta as a kind of student of Guardiola. And, you know, that it was almost kind of people saying that their methods had been superseded. If you look now, obviously City, the most consistent team in the league, they've got the best defence. The next best defence is Spurs. Obviously, Mourinho will always usually have a good defence. And then it's Arsenal after that. So, you know, Arsenal and City have got this kind of basis that they're both building consistency on. And, you know, Arsenal are now level on points with Chelsea, who were title contenders, in inverted commas, a few months ago. And they're only 5 points behind West Ham, who are in fourth place. So, you know, Champions League qualification is kind of looming now for Arsenal, and that would be huge. You know, they've been out of the competition for so long, and it really has affected, you know, who they can buy, their finances. And, you know, Michael said about it's surprising that he rotated so much in the FA Cup, and it is a shame for them that they got knocked out. But I think, you know, they really have got a chance to concentrate on the league here and finish higher than they have for quite a few seasons.
Duncan Bold calls Alexander. Which do you think is more likely, them getting into the top four or Sheffield United staying up?
Probably Arsenal getting into the top four. It pains
but it's
me
close,
to say,
isn't it? You have to think about it. All right. Well, let's get on to the rest of the midweek action, including Chelsea and Man City and all the rest of them after this.
Now, sir, remember, a tattoo is permanent, so tell me one more time what you want. Well, I want Bruno Fernandes knocking a Liverbird off its perch with a free kick, with Ollie as a kind of, like, god in the sky. Oh, and Champions 2021 on top as well.
I can't see anything going wrong there, Man United fan. But if things don't go exactly as expected, Paddy Power's Acca Insurance gets you a free bet if one leg of your 4+-fold Acca lets you down. Paddy Power! Max free bet £10, min odds 1 to 5 on each leg. Online exclusive, excludes shop bets, excludes enhanced match odds. T's and C's apply, 18+, begambleaware.org.
This is the Totally Football Show, part of the Athletic Podcast Network. The Athletic is the only place you can read articles by Daniel Taylor, Amy Lawrence, Phil Hay, James Pearce, Ollie Kay, and the very best football writers around.
Quick check on the table. City are now top, of course, a point clear of neighbours Man United, 2 points ahead of third place Leicester. West Ham are fourth. That's ahead of Spurs' clash with Liverpool Thursday evening. Spurs currently sixth and Liverpool fifth. At the other end, Burnley are now 9 points clear of trouble, while last place Sheffield United, as mentioned, are a mere 10 points from safety. Thomas Tuchel is the new Chelsea manager. That's right. Tuesday at Stamford Bridge, we got our first look at him, dressed in a blue tracksuit on the Stamford Bridge sidelines. Has his lateral thinking side set new passing records, but failed to trouble a visitor's Wolves net. Tactically, this is a bit kind of the DMZ, you know, kind of like a no man's land between the old style Frank football and the new Tuchel ball. But anything we should take from the extraordinary number of completed passes, a record number of completed passes, in fact, in this game?
Yeah, I mean, it reminded me of the Jurgen Klopp's first game when Liverpool went to White Hart Lane and everyone kind of was so obsessed with seeing differences, and Liverpool did run further in that match, and suddenly everyone was like, it's gegenpressing, it's heavy metal football. But, you know, as you said, it's such a short time since they changed managers. I think the first 15, 20 minutes of the game, you could see a real difference. I mean, Chelsea seems to be playing a lot more one-touch football than they have recently. And they looked pretty dangerous for that first 20 minutes, had a couple of good chances. But then after that, it did kind of, you know, Wolves, to be fair, put in a very good defensive performance, and it did become a bit sterile. Although it did improve towards the end when Pulisic and Mason Mount came on, who I think, you know, that was the big news before the game, was that Mason Mount had been dropped. You know, obviously Tuchel came out and said, I think the supporters would have liked what they saw. 16 recoveries in the last third is proof of energy on the pitch. But you do wonder whether he's ever studied Chelsea supporters and what they demand. But it's too early to tell. But they could have easily won that game, and then everyone would have said, oh, look, Tuchel's come in and made an instant impact.
What do you expect from him then going forward, Michael and Natalie? And how do you think, what's the first thing he needs to do, and how do you think he's going to try and manage that?
Well, first, I think we have to try not to read too much into yesterday's match, and especially with the selections, because Tuchel himself, before the match, he said that today he had chosen a bit more experienced side, and it was the most unfair lineup, because he had just one training session. So I don't think it's necessarily a big deal that he dropped Mason Mount and he dropped Reece James. I think we have to wait, and maybe Mason Mount will be back next match. And I think a few things that we can expect from him is that I think we have to let go of the idea that he's going to have, that Chelsea is going to have a starting 11, because that's just not his way of working. And he offers different solutions. So he went to a back three, which we haven't seen at Chelsea for a while now. And he changes tactics during the matches, and he gives different roles to players. So when he arrived at PSG, he was the first thing he did was to give Neymar the number 10 role for him to play in a different way. He put Marquinhos as a defensive midfielder. So I expect him to do a few things like that with Chelsea players. Yesterday, Hudson Odoi playing on the right, he was brilliant. He was really good. Chelsea had almost 79% possession, 13 shots and 5 on target. As Duncan mentioned, they looked more confident and a little bit more intense at first, but we still saw that bit of lack of confidence that Chelsea has been showing, and it's not going to disappear overnight, you know. So I'm excited to see Tuchel working at Chelsea. He said after the match, if this was the starting point, I'm looking forward to where we can get to. And I'm with him. Yes, I'm looking forward. Yeah,
I think it was a tough first game for him, actually, because Wolves are just so negative, really, without the ball. They sit so deep and defend so solidly that there was no real space in behind. And indeed, to be fair, Chelsea didn't really have many players going in behind without Werner, without Pulisic. And actually, if you look at the run of fixtures that the Tuchel's got, it's Wolves, Burnley, Tottenham, Sheffield United and Newcastle. They must be five of the teams that sit the most deep in the Premier League. So I think we're going to see quite a lot of this. We're going to see a lot of possession, maybe not much penetration. But yeah, as Natalie says, with one day on the training ground, I'm not sure we can really judge too much from what he did. Maybe with the exception of Hudson-Odoi, who I don't think has ever played wing-back before, but I thought was probably Chelsea's brightest player down the right. And actually did quite well when he went to the left late on. So that was interesting. But aside from that, it was, I just thought, a really flat game, really.
OK. Tuchel won 6 trophies in 2.5 years at Paris Saint-Germain, plus the Pokal at Dortmund. And he took Paris Saint-Germain to their first ever Champions League final. Which current manager, here's a quiz question, in a major European league, started his coaching career by doing scouting for Thomas Tuchel?
Nagelsmann, wasn't it?
Oh, goodness sake. There he is. 2-0 from Michael Cox. More questions to come. Chelsea facing Burnley this weekend. Burnley, for all their sitting deepness, 3-2 winners Wednesday in a thriller with Villa. Quite a finale here. Villa were 2-1 up with a quarter of an hour to go before Burnley came storming back. They've now scored 3 goals in 2 games in a row after that 3-0 at Fulham in the Cup. Wow. And a week ago, they won at Anfield. So that's 3 wins in 7 days. Crikey.
They did it in the very Burnley way. Their XG for the game was 0.48 and they scored 3 goals. The only other team to get through or more goals with less than 0.5 this season was Leeds on the opening day against Liverpool. So, you know, Sean Dyche extracting gold from rocks.
With a team built for a bag of chips, as he explained after the game. Beyond the bag of chips, who do you want to give credit to? Nick Pope?
Yeah, well, Villa dominated first half, but Burnley, they were very dangerous with their crosses. And I think it's just remarkable how season after season, with all the limitations that we know Burnley has, Sean Dyche is able to keep the fighting spirit of this team. And they get results like that. So that's what impresses me about Burnley, just season after season.
Mm. Do you fancy their chances at Stamford Bridge this weekend?
I think they're going to put a fight against Chelsea, but the Tuchel factor of things, I think it will prevail.
Mm. Michael, what do you think?
I think they could frustrate Chelsea for long periods. I thought the interesting thing about this game was Dwight McNeil got a goal and an assist, and he hasn't got either of them since September. When you consider how good he was last season, he carried so much of their attacking threat. If he's coming back into form, then I think that's a big boost for them. And yeah, I wouldn't be surprised if they got something against Chelsea, actually. Just because I think there's a danger Chelsea would do what they did yesterday, just hold possession without really having any means to break down the opposition. Again, I think that could be quite an interesting game.
Also on Wednesday in the Premier League, there were draws for Everton and Leicester and Brighton and Fulham. Natalie, you spent your evening watching the game at Goodison as Everton and Leicester finished 1-1. Did you regret your choice given what was happening at Old Trafford?
Well, I confess that on second half, I paid more attention to Man United's match. I was trying to keep up with both of them. Well, Leicester had 18 shots, but Everton defended really deep. And I think there's something about Everton that that is interesting. And if they can keep up with that, it'd be ideal because they can be very clever under Ancelotti. They can read the game well. Like, they're not ashamed to sit back at first, found their spaces, and then they scored. But Leicester was completely dominating second half when they scored with Tielemans. And we have to talk about Pickford again because a goalkeeper like him, national team, everything. He needs to show more consistency in terms of not making poor mistakes like this, you know. I think it's already about time. But I wanted to talk about James, actually, because he hasn't scored in the Premier League since October. And I think this is what we can expect from James. I never expected a consistent season from him because he hadn't delivered a consistent season for a while now. Maybe ever since he played for Porto. But we see these glimpses of brilliantism and just pure talent. What a finish from him. And not only the goal, but the way that he moves and creates spaces. It's a bit like we saw in the beginning of the season. And I think if we adjust our expectations to James, not expecting that he will deliver week after week, match after match, because he has a history with injuries and everything, but he has a lot to offer to Leicester. And it's very enjoyable to see James play when he's in one of his nights, you know.
He was injured, but now he's cured. He's cured James. Gareth Southgate was, I think, there, was he not, to see this game? I'm just wondering, and not that there's many reasons why the rest of the world might look upon England at the moment and titter, but is Pickford being our keeper, is that just something that the rest of the world...
I have a theory that Gareth Southgate is everywhere.
Right.
See a match and he's there, yeah. So
right.
Pretty sure he was there.
But is that something that other nations talk about behind our back, Natalie, the fact that Pickford's our keeper?
I think most people still have this image of Pickford from the World Cup. So it's not as strong as it is here because we are always discussing Nick Pope and how well he's doing and how he should be maybe the first choice of goalkeeper for the national team. But yeah, I think that's it.
It's the Pierluigi Collina theory, isn't it? Where if you watched him every week, you'd see him make as many mistakes as any other referee. But when you just saw him occasionally, everyone in England was like, he's the best ref I've ever seen. But just on James, that was his 19th goal from outside the box in the top five European leagues. But the first one with his right foot. So collector's item.
Very nice. Leicester, who've only had one defeat in the last 13 games in all competitions, are only 2 points off the top. They look like sticking around for the long run, those two. Brighton and Fulham, who are both in a battle to stick around in the top flight, with the goalless draw. Brighton's still the only team in England yet to win a home match this season. No Premier League side has ever gone through a full campaign without securing a victory at home. Not even Derby.
Crystal Palace nearly did, but then they didn't.
All right. Well, we'll get on to Tuesday's action. Man City and that big Ibrahimovic-Lukaku showdown next.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard it right. You can talk to a real human in customer service anytime. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask me. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
You're listening to The Totally Football Show, sponsored by Paddy Power.
Four fixtures in the Premier League on Tuesday, but one of the biggest stories came 1,000 miles to the south in Milan, as Ibrahimovic and Lukaku went together in a real old head-to-head in the Coppa Italia quarter-final clash between Inter and Milan. Zlatan had put Milan 1-0 up when he and former Man United teammate Lukaku got involved in a massive half-time scrap. And thanks to the empty stadium, it proved a highly entertaining and pretty audible bit of telly. Ibra grinning menacingly, saying, "Go do your voodoo sh, you little donkey, and go call your mother." An irate Lukaku having to be held back. "F you and your wife. And, apparently, I'll shoot you in the head." Crikey. Joining us now on the line, James Horncastle. James, who started it?
I mean, that's a difficult question to answer, James, because I wasn't on the pitch and I was only able to see what we were shown by the match director. The assumption, I suppose, is that Zlatan started it with the kind of trash talking that we saw last weekend in the defeat to Atalanta, where even at 3-0 down, he was telling Duvan Zapata that he'd scored more goals than Duvan Zapata had played games in his professional career. And Zlatan, I suppose, tried to rile up Lukaku in, you know, what is one of the biggest games, if not the biggest game on the fixture list for both of these clubs. And it got very ugly.
Yeah, well, we've not seen Lukaku lose his rag in quite that fashion. So Zlatan certainly succeeded. As it turned out, it was Lukaku who in this match had the last laugh because they both got a yellow card. Ibra then gets a fairly soft second yellow and gets sent off. They were 1-0 up at this point, Milan, but then Lukaku converts a penalty to make it 1-1. And 10-man Milan hold on to the 97th minute until what happens next?
Eriksen con il destro ed è lui che la mette in porta. E questo è un derby che si ricorderà.
Well, the most unexpected match winner, I suppose, because albeit it's only a year since Christian Eriksen signed for Inter and was unveiled at La Scala, the opera house in Milan, as this new virtuoso. He finally scored for the first time in, what, 6 months? First time this season. And it was the kind of free kick that I thought a lot of people believed he would be kind of curling in when he joined 12 months ago. So could very well be his last kick as an Inter player. But I think, you know, given how much he makes, how much Inter want for him, it's going to be pretty difficult as well for him to find a new club between now and the end of the transfer window. But what a moment.
Yeah, what pressure as well. Because 97th minute, as I say, it was 1-1 heading to extra time. And he, the player who never gets any minutes under Antonio Conte, with the free kick, with the chance to settle it. And boy, did
well,
he deliver.
This is the thing with him, is that you say he doesn't get any minutes. I mean, it felt classic Conte, because Conte's been sort of accused of humiliating Eriksen, even though that's something he denies, by basically putting him on in the 89th minute in games. And he more or less did that this time, except there was 10 minutes of extra of added time. So he ended up getting 12 or 15 minutes, whereas he has considerably less time usually to impress. But I think as well, you saw one of Milan's January signings, Meite. He was the guy who gave away the foul right on the edge of the area. Certainly hasn't had a very good start to his Milan career. He was subbed at halftime against Atalanta. Inter going through to the semi-finals, where they will play a less intense game, a game with less poise and less rivalry, against Juventus, James.
Woof! Two-legged affair, which begins next week. Of course, Inter schooled Andrea Pirlo's Juve when was that? A couple of weeks ago in the league. Yeah. Excellent stuff. In the other semi-final, it'll be Atalanta against Napoli or Spezia, because they play this Thursday evening. James, thank you so much for that.
Pleasure.
And look forward to speaking to you next Tuesday in our Euro Roundup. The Gazzetta this week explaining how the beef between them goes way, way back. Of course, when Lukaku scored in a derby, he declared Milan has a new king, in reference to Ibrahimovic. And Ibra replied, "We never had a king here. It's always been a god." But even before that, when they were teammates briefly at Man United, Ibra reveals that he actually bet Lukaku 50 quid that he couldn't trap a football. He said, "I will give you £50 sterling every time you manage to trap a ball." And Lukaku never took him up on the offer. Wow. Aklif Hanif says, after the Lukaku-Ibrahimovic face-off what is the panel's most memorable on-field bust-up? Sorry to spring that on you. Anyone spring to mind?
Dion Dublin once headbutted Robbie Savage, and a lot of football headbutts are very sort of just, you know, pressing your head against someone. This was a proper, right. Yeah, that was quite good.
Of course, there's the Blackburn in Moscow moment, and of course Newcastle as well. But Natalie, no doubt there have been some crackers in Brazil. Edmundo, perhaps.
Edmundo would be a good guess. Yes, we've had quite a few, probably in Libertadores. But there's the Orconcour, Zidane-Materazzi World Cup final.
Indeed. Nobody likes to see it. And let's hope that calmer heads prevail going forward. Back to the Premier League. Tuesday saw Arsenal with that come-from-behind win at Saints. Man City with a 5-0 win over West Brom. West Ham poking their noses into the top four with a 3-2 win at Palace. What a week for West Ham, eh? Frank Lampard gets sacked and they break into the Champions League places. What's the story behind the Hammers? Because of all the things we were pretty certain of back in August, it's that things were going to go spectacularly wrong there at London Stadium with David Moyes brought back in after not really thrilling them the first time around. Key players like Grady Diangana sold off. It was all going to go wrong. Instead, it's all gone right. Why and how?
I think West Ham, they have been making it hard for teams on the top of the table for a while, and that's why they're fourth, because they made it very hard for Liverpool on the reverse fixture, because they're playing again this weekend. And more recently, they lost to United, they lost to Chelsea, but they compensated by, they didn't drop points on matches that they couldn't drop points, like Crystal Palace, West Brom, Burnley. They got a win against Everton, so they got these key results. Maybe they will not get 3 points against Liverpool, but they are consistent in this sense. And I enjoyed David Moyes' interview after the midweek fixture, where the reporter said, "Oh, so you guys are fourth in the league?" And he said, "Could you repeat that? Yes, you guys are fourth in the league." And he was like, "Yes, thank you. We're not saying that we're gonna fight for the Champions League, but it's interesting to see what he has been doing for West Ham. And who would have thought that the weekend's match against Liverpool would be a battle for top four? It's bizarre to think that.
Whoever's in charge of recruitment at West Ham is doing a pretty special job. Five of the starting team that took on Palace on Tuesday were all signings made under David Moyes' tenure, and all proved massively influential. Soufar perhaps not so much, but Craig Dawson, who scored, and I think most Hammers fans weren't even aware he was with them until the start of this year. Thomas Souček with 2 goals. Jared Bowen's been brilliant for them. Saeed Benrahma, who's running things in the middle. All, as I say, arriving under David Moyes for a very limited amount of money. Is that the reason? It's basically just some very, very astute transfer business. And is there going to be a bit more, do you think, before this week is out?
Yeah, I mean, I think Souček and Soufar have done particularly well, but I think more the organisation of the side has been really good. With all due respect to those players, if you put them in another, you know, bottom half Premier League side, I'm not sure they'd look quite so good. I've been really impressed with them. And I think the central midfield in particular has been a big upgrade. I said, I think last time I was on this podcast, I watched the game against Burnley and I was really impressed with Souček and Rice and how they just commanded the centre of the pitch. And they just look a lot more, can I say this, a lot more disciplined without Mark Noble, who is a bit of a club legend and is a very good passer of the ball. But I've always thought without the ball, he's just never in the right position. And I think he's always caused his teammates problems because of that. And these two, I think, are just much better at that and provide a basis for the likes of Benrahma was good in this game against Crystal Palace. I thought Fornals made some really clever little contributions. So yeah, they're just a better all-round side than they were a couple of years ago, certainly.
4:30 this Sunday afternoon, Liverpool visit. What are people going to be repeating to David Moyes after this game, do you think?
You're in third, David. I mean, Souček's got the capability of causing Liverpool a lot of problems, particularly with their, you know, continuing issues at central defence. You know, his record with headed goals is really good. And I know it's a bit of a cliche, but he is kind of performing that Fellaini role that Fellaini did so well for Moyes at Everton. And we've said before that it's really good and pleasing that Moyes is having this kind of, you know, late career rehabilitation, because this season's kind of perfectly set up for him. It is very much a season we haven't seen for sort of 15, 20 years in the Premier League, where it's kind of a series of mini seasons where you might have injury crises or you might not play for 2 or 3 weeks. And, you know, he is a really good manager at kind of being pragmatic and cutting his cloth to just for the next game rather than a kind of empire builder. It reminds me a little bit of 1985-86 when West Ham came third. They were obviously the highest London club that season. And, that's one of the few seasons they've ended a top flight season with a positive goal difference. And it'll be good to see him, you know, repeat that.
Or does it remind you as well of the kind of mid to late noughties when Everton under David Moyes were finishing top four? And is that an equivalent kind of achievement?
Yeah, I think it is. And I think Everton, they got into the Champions League that season with 60 points, I think, which is the lowest ever to finish top four and get in the Champions League. And it's probably not going to be quite as low this season, but it is going to be lower than normal. And it does give teams like Leicester, like West Ham, possibly Southampton, although that has tailed off, you know, a chance, an outside chance of doing it. And it's good for the competitiveness of the league.
Mm. Now, meanwhile, on top of the Premier League and looking ominous, are Man City. Richard Keys is a visionary. He suggested Big Sam could help Man City keep clean sheets, and so it proved on Tuesday. Sasu Haino says, why are Manchester City winning all the games now? Are they playing better? And if so, what is the reason? Will they break away from the others in February? What do you think, Michael?
I think there's a danger of that. Yeah, a danger of them breaking away, which would be quite a shame considering this season's been so exciting because it's been so topsy-turvy. But at the moment, I can't really see Manchester United or anyone else keeping up with them. They do look really, really good. I think particularly in this game, it was impressive considering they were without Kevin De Bruyne, who I think has completely dominated the side for the last 18 months or so. The rise of Gundogan, I think in particular, is the obvious factor. I mean, he's just scoring so many goals. But I think on top of that, just his all-round game has been good. He's collecting the ball in clever positions. He's a very neat and tidy passer without being necessarily the real expressive assist merchant De Bruyne is. And they're looking solid at the back as well. I mean, Ruben Dias has got a lot of credit, but I think just the entire side has looked much more solid. So, yeah, I've really enjoyed watching him the last few weeks. I hope they don't run away with it because I would like a fun title race. Title race, I should say. Mm. But, they were great here.
Yeah, Gundogan. Sorry, possibly everyone else was aware of this, but for me, it's a bit like, you know, in the thriller when the butler rips off his dinner jacket and reveals himself as a secret agent. It's this killer instinct that I had no idea was there.
It's been a while since we haven't seen Gundogan playing so well. I think before his injury, his long-term injury, the knee operation that he had, he was doing really well, and then he got injured. But I think there are a lot of interesting things happening in City. Gundogan, of course, is one of them. You see João Cancelo and the way that he's playing as a midfielder as well. Because when Kevin De Bruyne got injured, it was never a matter of who will replace Kevin, because nobody can replace him. Nobody can do the things. It was never a one-man job. So everybody's just pitching in. So you have João Cancelo doing different things and exploring different areas of the pitch. You have Gundogan scoring. You have Bernardo Silva improving. You have Rodri even. That I was a bit skeptical about Rodri because I think it took a while for him to get to where he is, but he got it and he is there, and he's been delivering so many good performances. And Phil Foden, of course. This week I spoke to Ederson, and we were talking about Rubén Dias, of course, and they played together in Benfica. Rubén Dias is younger, but he used to play with the professionals as well, and Ederson said that Rubén Dias always had a strong leadership, that he was just an 18-year-old and he went up and spoke to the captain, and he just showed a lot of personality on the pitch, and that explains a little bit why he settled in so well. And even Ederson, he was saying that he's more dedicated to his physical part, because he lost weight, he changed his diet, he changed his training, he lost fat percentage, so he's feeling better in terms of his physical. And so there are a lot of things happening to City, and we can see it on the table.
Mm. Cancelo scoring a goal in this one. How did you feel about that Cancelo goal? Of course, the West Brom players, several of them had stopped because Sean Massie had put the flag up over on the sideline.
I thought it was just really unfortunate, and I don't actually necessarily think she was wrong to raise the flag. I mean, it seems she was wrong with the offside, but the job is to raise your flag when there's an offside, unless there's really a direct situation where a goal's going to be scored. And I think she waited to the point where Bernardo Silva had the ball almost next to the corner flag, was being faced up by a defender. I don't think you can say there's a reasonable chance of a goal coming from that situation. And she was a little bit unlucky, really, that obviously Cancelo smacked it in the top corner from 25 yards. The other point, and this is a slight tangent, but I do think it's relevant, is I was recently at a WSL game at Kingsmeadow where Massie Ellis was the linesman there. And there were a couple of situations where she really let the play run on a lot and then flagged. And this is a game or a league where there's no VAR. So it was almost like she was accustomed to the VAR system and then found it difficult when she was going to non-VAR system. And I think, I'm not quite sure how many linesmen are doing that, but it must be quite difficult to switch between, right, actually, because it's the fundamental part of your job, which is completely changing. So I just felt a bit sorry for her, really. I thought she got a bit unlucky with that.
Mm, and West Brom as well, although, you know, given the final score, perhaps it wouldn't have made much difference. Interesting, though, that the last City game that they had last Wednesday also involved a controversial offside goal. You remember that's the one with Rodri coming back on Tyrone Mings. I think now that Pogmol and UEFA have perhaps amended the rule a bit, they said if a similar situation to that one occurs in a future match, the impact, as they say, will be penalised for offside, which I think a lot of people wanted in the first place.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not a big fan of just changing interpretations mid-season, because it kind of, I mean, as some United fans pointed out after the discussion of the disallowed goals or not disallowed goals against Sheffield United, that, you know, the week before, City had benefited from a goal that would no longer count if it happened this week. So I think if you make changes, do it at the end of the season after seeing the effect. But it seems a little bit kind of, you know, putting paper mache over a leaking hole as it stands.
Wouldn't that wouldn't work, would it? Once it's set, would paper mache?
I'm not a paper mache expert. We would hold it once it's set, yeah. We should just point out that on the defensive front for West Brom, Sam Allardyce is now letting in 3.14 goals a game, not the sort of pie that he enjoys usually. he's the only manager in Premier League history to, within a season, to concede over 3 goals a game. So, you know, the shoring up of West Brom has not happened yet. And obviously he kept the team locked in the dressing room for an hour after the game.
Yeah, 22 goals conceded in 7 games under Big Sam. In the last 7 games under Slaven Bilic, only 12 different matches, etc. But certainly not had the desired effect just yet. Also on Tuesday, Leeds got back to winning ways and goal-scoring ways with a 2-1 win away at Newcastle, who have now had 6 defeats out of 6 in all competitions in 2021, which is their worst run in almost 6 years, which has a nice symmetry to it. Next up, let's have a bit more of a look at the weekend.
This episode is brought to you by Michelob Ultra, the official beer sponsor of the NBA. Want to get closer to the game than ever before? Michelob Ultra Courtside is giving fans the chance to win exclusive NBA prizes and experiences like official gear, courtside seats to an NBA game, and more. Head over to MichelobUltra.com/courtside to learn more.
On Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Smart Speaker, and now ad-free on The Athletic, this is The Totally Football Show with James Richardson.
28th of January, listener, and on this day in 1961, something remarkable happened. Dennis Law scored 6 goals in 1 FA Cup fourth round match against Luton, but still didn't win. It's true. Law scored all 6 of City's goals as they led 6-2 at Kenilworth Road after 69 minutes, but the game was then abandoned due to a waterlogged pitch. In the rearranged fixture, 4 days later, Luton were victorious. And so City went out and Law's goals were expunged from the record books. That doesn't seem fair in any way.
Seems absolutely fair. It's a game that doesn't count.
To me, it feels really unfair that you should be 6-2 up with 20 minutes to go and then you have to start from scratch and the other lot win the game.
Well, I mean, there's two schools of thought. There's the English school, which is you just scrap it and replay the game, or there's the continental way, which is you just pick up the game from where it stopped. There was a Real Madrid game in the Galacticos era where they actually, I think it was away at Sociedad or Deportivo maybe, and they basically had 5 minutes left to play, but you're allowed to change the team. They needed a goal, so they basically came out with like seven up front, scored the goal, and then made a series of defensive substitutions and hung on. See, for me, that seems more ridiculous than just replaying the whole game. But
that must have been a hell of a 5 minutes, though.
There was some great like La Liga fixture nonsense around that time, because I think it was around that period where Barcelona were told they had to play a game on a Tuesday rather than a Monday or something, and wanted to play it on the Monday, so had it kick off at like 2 minutes past midnight, which was just incredible, and yet also not that late by Spanish standards, which I quite liked.
Yeah. Oh, the Spanish. Now, quiz question. Quiz question. Dennis Law had a brief spell playing in Italy for which club?
Torino.
Hey, Duncan's on the board. How are you doing, listener? Really? Excellent. Now, on to this weekend's games. Here's the fixtures. Saturday lunchtime is Everton Newcastle. Then you've got three games at 3 o'clock. You have to choose between Palace Wolves, Man City Sheffield United, and West Brom Fulham. Which way are you leaning on that one, Natalie?
I think Man City Sheffield United.
Really?
Yeah. Okay. Well, I've been enjoying watching City, so.
Yeah, fair. Arsenal against Man United is your tea time entertainment with Saints Villa from 8 o'clock. On Sunday, Chelsea take on Burnley. Then it's Leicester Leeds. West Ham hosts their top four rivals Liverpool at 4:30 before Brighton Spurs concludes the weekend's fun. Now, we've mentioned West Ham Liverpool, and of course, we're yet to see what Liverpool do Thursday night against Spurs. And we've also talked about Arsenal's clash with Man United. What else are you looking forward to this weekend, Michael?
I'm looking forward to a game that I'm not best placed to speak about, which is the Copa Libertadores final.
Right, we'll be talking about that a little bit later on. And we know somebody who is well placed to talk about that, don't we, Natalie?
Yes, I am very much looking forward to this match as well.
Before that, that's coming up Saturday evening, and it's on BBC's Red Button iPlayer thing. So, yeah, that'll be nice from the Maracanã. Duncan, what are you looking forward to, apart from the ones we've already talked about? Anything else?
I think Leicester Leeds is interesting because they're two teams that have been very reliant on their centre forwards, you know, Jamie Vardy and Bamford. Bamford's form has really tailed off, and he's just not getting the high XG chances that he was earlier in the season, and unlike in the Championship, he was knocking them in. So, you know, Leeds are having to kind of work out a way of scoring without him. Obviously, Rafinha's stepped up. Leicester, as we mentioned earlier, they were very dominant at Everton. They had a lot of possession, but they haven't really found a way of... It almost felt, watching the highlights of that game, if Leicester had Calvert-Lewin, they would be a genuine kind of title contenders, I think.
Well, they've got Jamie Vardy, of course, but they just don't have him at the moment.
Well, yeah, but even when he's fit, he hasn't been scoring other than penalties that much, and particularly at home, and they're at home in this game, and that has been their kind of tricky... a location this season. So I think this is a really big game for Leicester. If they can win this, it'll keep them well in the mix. But it is also the sort of game where you feel like Bielsa will have learned a lot from the reverse fixture, and will have come up with some sort of approach to try and nullify what Leicester do. So yeah, I think this will be probably the most kind of interesting game of the weekend for me.
Okay. Huge game at the bottom, or perhaps not, and ultimately unlikely to change much. And I'm referring to West Brom's clash with Fulham. They're both in the bottom three at the moment. Mm. Here's a mighty stat for you. Duncan, you may know this, but we mentioned that West Brom have conceded loads of goals under Allardyce. It's 17 in just four home games under Big Sam. In fact, all of the last 21 goals scored at the Hawthorns have come courtesy of West Brom's opposition. Good Lord. That's the longest run of goals scored against a single team in one stadium in Premier League history.
And that includes Bilic's last match, which was a 5-1 defeat to Palace. Obviously, you add in that additional goal there, that's 22 goals. That's the worst run of conceding goals in home games in a row since the 1930s. So it really is kind of unprecedented defensive calamity for West Brom. I think it's quite interesting them playing Fulham in the sense that, you know, Scott Parker has shown... that he's learnt this season. You know, Fulham had a terrible start. He's switched the system around. He's tried different players. He's tried different methods. And he's actually, you know, I think of the teams down there, Fulham look like they've got, they're the most adventurous. And, you know, Allardyce would have ring-fenced this game as a 3 points in his kind of recovery. But at the moment, I can't really see it happening.
Wow. Okay. Natalie, what have you got ringed in red on your weekend fixture list?
Well, I think that there is Southampton Aston Villa who will be interesting, even though it's on the same time as the Libertadores match. So it's too bad for me, but it will be interesting because it's two teams who haven't been on the best form, just one win in the past five matches. They're very close in the table. Aston Villa is 10th, Southampton is 11th. So I think they're both trying to find themselves again, find their best form. And two teams that play really well, that have individual talent. So it should be interesting if you're not watching Libertadores.
Okay. Or you can always do it on catch-up. They've lost their last four games against Saints, have Villa. Also this weekend, as we mentioned, Brighton against Spurs. That's late Sunday, a fixture which Brighton won 3-0 last season. But that would involve them actually getting a win at home, which hasn't happened yet so far this campaign. Ooh, Duncan.
That was the game. I think it came just after the Bayern Munich match, when the Pochettino era was kind of crashing around. It was the one where Lloris had that really horrible injury as well, when he kind of fell back on his arm. So, and that was after like a minute or two. Was this also the game that the Michael and me like, where Aaron Connolly referenced Premier League years in the post-match interview?
I think you're right. I think it was. Yeah. Here's a game that we're all looking forward to this weekend. Crystal Palace against Wolves. Give us a quick word, if you can, Natalie, about William José, the new Brazilian goalscorer for Wolves.
Yeah, I think Premier League can really help him develop. He had a pretty successful spell in Spain. He makes me feel kind of old because I remember when he started playing professional in São Paulo, and I covered his beginning. And he was always seen as a prolific goal scorer. I don't think he developed to the level that was expected, but I think Premier League football can bring this to him. And of course, it's very different to play for Real Sociedad. He hasn't been playing a lot. He's been on and off the team. And now at Wolves, I think he really can help them in the score sheet. But he's tall, strong presence on the area, really good at headers. He's very serious, very professional. I'm hoping he will do well under Nuno.
How good a like-for-like replacement is he for Raul Jimenez?
I think they're different, definitely. They're both good with the set pieces and headers, but I think William José, I think Raul Jimenez has more mobility than William José. They're different players, but I think he can add up to Wolves' attacking form, definitely.
Okay. Well, we may see him in action this Saturday afternoon. Well, very shortly then, we'll hear about the biggest game of the weekend, the Copa Libertadores final at the Maracanã. Let's get some odds, though, first from Lee Price from Paddy Power.
Hello, listeners. It's been troubling me for a while, but I think I've finally worked out what's happened at Man United. The experts had written them off and predicted their downfall, only for their stock to go through an unexpected and, frankly, inflated rise. Yep, simply put, it's the work of the Reddit community once again sticking it to the man, Chester City. But the game has stopped, and United's loss to Sheffield United abruptly ended talk of their title challenge. They're now as long as 11-1 to win the league, behind even Liverpool. Imagine that. Worse still, they're only just favourites to be Arsenal. GameStop United are 7-5, the Wall Street Gunners are 7-4. Now, for those of you who have no idea what I'm talking about, let me explain. The second number is how much you bet. The first number is how much profit you stand to get if your bet wins. Sheffield United, for whom I haven't quite worked out a stock market equivalent, I don't know if they've got a stock market in Saudi Arabia actually, are 20-1 to complete the Manchester double this week. I don't want to sell you short, or short sell you, but I think that's enough number wang from me. I'll leave you with this. it's 3-1 that Timo Werner scores the first goal of the Thomas Tuchel regime at Chelsea. Because narrative. Bye-bye.
You can find out these odds and more at paddypower.com or the Paddy Power app. Prices are accurate at the time of recording. It's over 18s only. Terms and conditions apply. And when the fun stops, stop. Woof. All right then, Michael. Saturday night, it is the Copa Libertadores final. Palmeiras against Santos at the Maracanã. Natalie, how big is this game?
Oh, it's huge, especially for Brazilians, because it's two Brazilian teams who beat two very traditional Argentinian teams, especially on Libertadores, River Plate and Boca Juniors. And it's a very tight final. Palmeiras has a better group of players. Santos has more individualities. Both showed remarkable like fighting spirit, especially Santos. And there's a lot of interesting things about this final. The managers, because a few Brazilian teams started to change their strategies. They hired these low-profile managers that have different ideas, and that's what Palmeiras did with Abel Ferreira. He's a Portuguese manager, and he completely turned the season around for Palmeiras. But Santos, on the other hand, they have a very old school Brazilian manager, experienced, Cuca, and he also turned things around for Santos. So it's pretty remarkable how they had different strategies, different plans, and they both worked out really well. And of course, not having fans on the stadium is always a thing this season. But for Libertadores, it's especially hard to imagine a Libertadores final without any fans, because Libertadores is known for the atmosphere. It's quite unique. It can be very hostile. You frequently see police officers inside the pitch protecting the players with shields when they are just taking corners, so nothing hits them. And so it will be weird. And you have young players who may play in Europe very shortly, so it's worth it to keep an eye on Gabriel Menino. He's 20 years old. He can play as a right back or midfielder. He plays for Palmeiras, and he's already getting calls from the national team. There's Gabriel Veron. He's 18. He's an attacking player, and there are already rumors about Man City and Man United interested in him. Maybe it's too early because his performance is still very a lot. And you have Caio Jorge from Santos. He's also 18. He's the top scorer for the team. So there's plenty to look at.
Gabriel Menino, so Gabriel yes. Boy, and Gabriel Veron. Is he named after, you know, the last Veron that Man United bought? Juan Sebastian?
Yes, I don't think so. Well, it's a possibility.
Okay.
Yeah, maybe.
I mean, you know, we're around about that point, aren't we?
Yes, yes.
Interesting.
That's true.
Yeah. Interesting. Okay, well, yeah, you mentioned the kind of fiery nature of these clashes and this being a state of São Paulo derby. River Boca, when they had their derby clash in the Libertadores, it had to be played on a different continent, but this time around, no fans allowed at the Maracanã, which is a huge shame for a billion reasons, of course. Which team should we root for, Natalie? Could you just in brief one note on like who are Palmeiras and who are Santos? Santos, I know, because of Pele.
Yes. Well,
is he playing? Is he playing this weekend?
He'd be up for it.
Yeah. So, as a Corinthians fan, I would say you should support Santos because Palmeiras is our biggest rivalry.
Okay.
But Palmeiras, in terms of management, they've been doing really well on organizing the club, on rethinking structures. And Santos has been a mess. So it depends on which you appreciate more. The overcoming spirit of Santos against everything, against all this mess that was going on at the club, or Palmeiras, who have been doing things well and got to the final in fair square, you know.
Okay, Santos have actually won the Libertadores three times in the past, two of those coming with Pelé. Palmeiras won it more recently, though, in 1999. Here's a quiz question for you, Natalie, and everybody. Which club have appeared in seven Copa Libertadores finals, winning them all?
Independiente.
Is correct. Woof.
Yeah, the biggest champions of Libertadores, Independiente, in a time in the 80s where there wasn't any anti-doping testing. So this was a big factor in Libertadores, and especially Independiente. There were a lot of rumors regarding this.
So they weren't so much Independiente as Dependiente.
Yeah.
All right, then. Excellent. Well, I look forward to that. So that's, I think, around 8 o'clock-ish. Is it 8:15 or something on Saturday evening?
It's 8 o'clock.
8 o'clock, okay.
Yeah.
Very good. And loads of football coming up on either side of that, which we'll be reviewing when we return in Monday morning's Totally Football Show. That wraps it up for today's edition. So many, many thanks to Natalie. Great to have you back with us. Also, Duncan Alexander and Michael Cox and you, listener. We'll catch up with you on the other side of the weekend. So have a great one. For now, from all of us here, it's goodbye.
You've been listening to The Totally Football Show, part of the Athletic Podcast Network. Keep up to date with everything Totally at thetotallyfootballshow.com and follow us at The Totally Show on Twitter and Insta. Check out all of The Athletic's football podcasts on Apple, Spotify and all the usual places, or listen ad-free on The Athletic app. The Totally Football Show is a Muddy Knees Media production and sponsored by Paddy Power.
Hi, I'm James McNicholas, and I'm here to tell you about the latest series from Beyond the Headline, the making of Big Sam. You see, Sam Allardyce seemingly can't quit English football, and English football can't quit him. But why? Why does football keep coming back to Sam Allardyce? To answer those questions and more, you'll hear from Big Sam himself, those who have worked for him, and those who've witnessed the full Big Sam experience. You can hear it all from February 1st and ad-free via the Athletic app. Just search for Beyond the Headline now.
The Athletic.
Looking for the best place to buy tickets for any of your favorite teams or sporting events? We've got the spot. Our partner, StubHub, has been the leading ticket marketplace in the world for over 20 years, providing a 100% guarantee with every order. From a worldwide selection of live events, the widest choice of tickets and industry-leading partnerships, StubHub has what you need to purchase with confidence. StubHub, an official partner of The Athletic.